WBAI 99.5 FM and available online at WBAI.org. It's 10 o'clock. Coming up next, Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Good morning. This is the professor, Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York. I welcome you to this November 20th, pre-Family Day. I'm not going to go to, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Family Day, holiday edition of Vantage Point here on 99.5 FM on WBAI, Pacifica Network, in collaboration with YCRadio.org. That's right, the York College radio station, where I do hail and be a professor. Great show. We hope today we have some legends online for you as we pay tribute to black theater and dramatic expressions. We have shortly joining us, again, Vi Higginson, and what a legend she is. Woody King, of course, will be joining us today. And Eugene Redmond coming to us all the way from out in Missouri, or Illinois, East St. Louis, Missouri. They'll be talking to us about black theater, their work in theater, and all those good things. Don't forget, we should always be talking about supporting WBAI, always, always, always. You can become a WBAI buddy. Don't have to wait for the pledge drive by simply donating as little as $10 a month. That comes out of your checking account or your savings account. You get tote bag, you get t-shirt, you get benefits. I mean, it's just an incredible deal. $120 a year, but it means you become a sustaining member to help WBAI not only survive but thrive, and that's what we need so we can continue programming like this and all of the rich variety of programs on WBAI. Well, again, today we're going to spend some time, and by the way, we appreciate all the excellent feedback we got from last week's show dealing with the status of drug policy reform in the era of Trump. We just got tremendous feedback all across the country from that show, and we just want to keep it rolling. So today, again, we want to talk about black theater, black dramatic productions and expressions, and what they mean to not only black people, but people in general. And we've assembled, again, a great, great group of people to help us deal with that conversation. Coming up first is a person that I first heard about from the legendary Bob Law. And he just raves over and over again. I just hear about Vi Higginson, Vi Higginson, Vi Higginson. And, of course, I would see her work and whatnot. And she has done so much. And so recently I saw a promotion for the most recent edition of her work, and I really wish I could go. I'm so bogged down and stuff. I said, I'm going to do a show, and I'm going to invite her to be a part of it, and Woody King and others, so we can talk about black theater and black dramatic productions. And so I wanted her to lead it off, and she agreed to do so. I was so thankful that she was available to do so. So we welcome to these microphones the legendary Vi Higginson. Welcome to Vantage Point. Oh, do we have her? Ooh, thought we had her. I guess we don't have her yet. Well, she'll be here in a minute if we don't have her yet to join us for our conversation. Anyway, many of you know her from her many, many productions, including the one that is, I guess, just wrapped up last week. And, of course, Woody King, the new Federal Theater. Eugene Redmond is the Poet Laureate for East St. Louis, Missouri, among other things. And he's the Poet Laureate for East St. Louis, and somebody I work with, actually, out in Kent State University. We're trying to actually connect with Vi Higginson as we speak. We'll keep trying. Let me just double check and make sure I have the number correct, because sometimes when you're stressing and straining, as I'm doing on so many, many fronts, you might just make a mistake in that regard. So we just want to double check to make sure we have the right number for her, because we really, really, really are looking forward to hearing from her in terms of the work that she has done and continues to do. Well, I'm checking the number, and it's the number I was given. So we just wait until she reconnect with her. We hope that that happens very, very soon. In any event, sort of contextually, the role historically of black art in theater from the Harlem Renaissance, but even before that, on through the present, has really been an integral part of the life of black people in this country. I would dare say that the church, obviously critically important to our survival as a people, but our creative expressions, you know, through black art. In fact, Haki Madhubuti has this poem. He talks about art, if you will, and it's been our saving grace, if you will. And so that's why we wanted to have the program today. I understand we do now have the legendary Vi Higginson online. So, Miss Vi Higginson, welcome to Vantage Point.
And a very pleasant good afternoon. Hello, how are you?
Well, I can talk to you after all these many years. I was just talking as we were making your introduction from Bob Law, who is my dear friend and a radio legend and much more. That's where I just first heard about Vi Higginson. He always is bragging and boasting about Vi Higginson. So I have to say, can I be blessed and have her on my show? And I'm so glad you agreed to be on.
Well, it is absolutely my joy. And Bob Law is the dearest and wonderful friend, my broadcast brother. And we have had some amazing communications experiences together, especially when I worked on his radio station. He was program director, and, you know, music to your ears when the program director said, "You can do what you want, I trust you." Ah! Then that was great.
Right. Well, let's talk a bit about your background. I mean, many, many people probably know it. I don't, and I always like to start this way by just sort of digging into your roots a little bit. Are you a native New Yorker, or do you hail from other parts?
No. I am a native New Yorker.
Okay.
I am born into a street in Harlem where my family has been for almost 100 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes, that's... my grandmother and my father and my mom and all of us have been on the same block in Harlem for almost 100 years.
Oh, my goodness. That is really, that's extraordinary. That's why I like to do these kinds of conversations, because people see you and so forth, but they don't realize that to be in the same spot, same place in Harlem for 100 years, that is in and of itself significant. What about your background in education? How did that shape up?
Well, two things happened in that regard. I went to high school, actually, in the Bronx, Theodore Roosevelt High School on Fordham Road, just across from Fordham University. And I attended the State University of New York at FIT, and I went to NYU for special classes and courses. So that's essentially what my educational background.
And you talked about radio. You ended up landing, you know, doing dramatic productions and so forth. So talk about the influences that shaped and directed you in that, along that path.
My radio influence came actually from my oldest sister, Doris Troy, who was always intrigued by the sound of my voice. I wasn't a singer, she was, but she would put me up and make me read the newspaper out loud because she liked the sound of my voice. And so that called attention that perhaps my voice was different than other young children. So many years later, when I was trying to figure out what to do with my life, I went to broadcasting school.
Mm.
And that's how it started. So it really was called, the talent was called to attention by my older sister.
Right.
But then also, I was in the fashion and beauty and marketing business, and there was a ceiling there. There wasn't so far you could go as a black person. So I figured I better make a shift.
Right.
And I went to the school, and I had a tape, and I wanted to use my experience in fashion and beauty to talk on the radio to other black women. And I heard about this new radio station, WLIB-FM, and this program director who used to be on WWRL. So I took a tape up to him to tell him, you know, this is what I want to do. He said, well, I don't want to do that, but I want to hire you as a disc jockey. And I said, no, I don't know how to be no disc jockey. I don't know. But afterwards, the general manager, and they convinced me that this was something I should do. And I was influenced by my other sister, said I had some other ideas. And she said, well, why don't you try it? If you don't like it, you can always quit. I never forgot that she said that.
Mm.
So then I called him back and I said, okay, I'll take the job. They paid $125 a week. That's how much you got for 6 days a week.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
Mm. Well, and in those days, eventually you eventually land over at WWR. But talk about just what it was like in those days. I'm from not here, so I just hear about the sort of the golden age of radio and all the DJs and all the great personalities. Take us back and talk a bit about that.
You know, it was an emerging time. It was after the civil rights movement, and people were finding each other and finding out about each other, and starting on the radio at that time and being the first woman in New York primetime radio was fresh and new and innovative. In fact, FM was fresh, new, and innovative.
Right.
From a technology standpoint. You see, prior to that, which is we're talking about the beginning of the 1970s now, there was only AM radio.
Right.
So FM was the new invention, the new technology. It was stereo in sound. It was no longer mono, it was stereo. And when you look back at that, and you realize the innovations that have been made in technology and computers and cell phones and et cetera, but that one shift made a generational difference in how people received their music. Up to that point, mono was the bomb, and all of the disc jockeys who were incredibly talented disc jockeys on RL, and they were, I would say, the first modern-day rappers, in fact, because they could talk a lot of stuff and do a lot of rhymes and had people totally engaged in the music. So when FM came, it was an opportunity to appeal and have a more a sophisticated approach to the emerging audience. And that approach was the total black experience in sound.
Mm.
At that time, that was the most amazing creative geniuses, musical geniuses, coming out of slavery and the civil rights movement. And the lyrics and the compositions and the instrumentations was very appealing to this emerging group. And so that's when WLIB-FM, which was an experiment in stereo and sound, captured the minds and the imagination of New York City.
Wow.
So, and it went from something very small and obscure to number one in the country. on this total black experience and sound, different shades of black, gospel, and jazz, and blues, and R&B. And it had an appeal, and it had a woman. So I always credit Frankie Crocker for taking a chance. And it was an all-male world, but he decided to be different, that he was going to hire this woman. And I think that team or that lineup made a difference.
Right. Well, eventually you get into theater and dramatic productions in a way that is, I mean, just can only be considered to so many milestones, but certainly a milestone way. And all of this incredible talent that your sister identified and also then began to tell you, try these different things and don't let nobody turn you around, and you didn't let nobody turn you around. So how did you get off into theater and dramatic productions?
Well, you know, my mother was an amazing woman after my father died, and she had to raise four young children by herself. And failure was not an option in her mind. She did whatever she had to do in order for us to thrive and survive. And we grew up on a lot of different sayings like, so a man thinketh, so a man is. Failure is not an option here. So we had to, you know, we had to team up and do what we had to do in order to make, you know, make ends meet. How did I get into theater? Well, I was telling this story to a gentleman that I met on television. I told him about my family and how my sister Doris Troy had this hit record called Just One Look, and how she took me with her to Europe, and how I worked with Ebony Magazine, and how the music had shifted from the total black experience and sound to disco music with the introduction to different instruments and technology and synthesizers, and the music shifted, and how we grew up in the church and how my father was a minister, and so there was music from the church and jazz from the local clubs on Lenox Avenue and R&B from the Apollo.
Wow.
So my whole life was surrounded by music. Everything that happened in our life was music. And I said, oh my God, you need to write that down. So how I got into it is through a friend of mine who later became my husband.
Oh, wow. Oh, what a great story. Oh, that is so fantastic. Oh, what a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful story. Well, and you, like you said, you kicked the door down in a major, major way, because all over the country, everybody heard about Mama, I Want to Sing. What was the inspiration behind that?
The inspiration is my family and this living on this block, 100 years on this block, you know, and my father being a minister, my sister being a singer, and, you know, and the Apollo being a half a block away. We're from 126th Street between Lenox and 7th. And so that was what told, you know, the story. And when we opened, and because nobody would accept us, many doors were slammed in our face, and we had to make a decision. And, you know, people would say, your show don't have no pimps and hoes and drugs and alcohol, nobody ain't gonna come see this show, something wrong with this. And so we said, well, I'll take a chance, and that's how it happened. And it the chance was an important chance because it really told more about who we are as a people and our choices and our decisions, and, you know, and that everybody is not what you see on television, in the news, killing and robbing and stealing in body bags. And so we wanted to do something that was more reflective of us.
And it was, I don't know exactly, but it was the longest running show.
Absolutely.
It
became, yes.
Wow.
Well, they accredited us really as introducing this phase of African-American theater, We ran for 8 solid years with 10 performances a week, 2 casts, 2 bands, 2 crews,
wow.
To accommodate here at the Heckscher Theater on Fifth Avenue, which had been abandoned for 15 years before we got in. And then we were evicted, actually, from the space by the then mayor, Ed Koch, which put it, but then we went on a road for 2.5 years, and we went to Europe and Japan. It's a Harlem story. It's a Harlem story about my family and my sister. And so next year, we'll be celebrating our 35th anniversary.
Oh,
and so we, you know, we want people to make sure that we do this level of revival and attention and all the people who came all of these years. And, you know, when we went to Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Australia, we played the West End of London. We played Istanbul, Greece, Italy. And then we have been going to Japan. In fact, we introduced the Japanese audience to gospel music. And now they are schools that have 700, 800 people learning gospel. And that's part of the reason why we do what we do here in Harlem with young people in the Mama I Want to Sing School of the Gospel, Jazz, and R&B Arts. So we make sure we never forget who we are and the contribution that we have made to the American musical and world landscape, and that we get full credit for our contribution.
Yeah, and that's what I want to talk about next is the current work, because you're not slowing down. It's like that song, I Ain't No Ways Tired. It's like manifested the work that you do, because you just keep rolling. And you just finished up, I guess, was it last Saturday, was it, or so? You finished up the most recent round. So talk about the foundation, what you do with young people, and the over 55 stuff. I mean, you just keep rolling here.
You know, it's not easy, and it's not. It's not. But I had a friend of mine who's 94 years old. She said to me the day before yesterday, you can sit down and whine, or you can get up and go. And I said, I'm taking that, I'm using it, because that's really the situation. You know, we can't forget who we are and where we come from musically. And when I see the landscape, you know, we love all kinds of music. And what we've come to believe is that music is medicine. But the menu has to be balanced. You can't forget where you came from.
Right.
You can't forget the reason why you can sing. And you can't ignore the talent or the genius that we demonstrate musically. So, you know, starting the school was a passion, really, because we were watching young people unable to sing the simplest hymn or the simplest song, and the songs that I grew up with my grandmother and my mom, you know, were just being shoved aside and pushed under the rug like it didn't even exist. And I just thought, that's not good. I have a daughter who turned out to be musical, and they took the music out of the schools and the school system. And so the math and science became the only thing or the only part of the brain that was considered genius. And the other young people who were musical or athletic was left behind. So I wanted to kind of address that. So I started with my daughter and some of her friends. And they just loved it, and they begged us to continue it. And now we're 10 years old. We've served thousands and thousands of young people who come and learn breathing, harmony, pitch, and control, and a repertoire of music that can last them a lifetime, so they can pass it on to their family, friends, and generation to generation, so the music never dies. That's the intention. That's the vision. And sometimes that vision, I have to tell you, gets cloudy because the program is free. I insist that it be free. And now, because of the cutbacks and the budget, people are saying that you have to charge these kids to learn their history. And I'm like, no, we got to do something. Right. And that's where the real challenge comes in, you know. Right. But yes, the MAMA Foundation for the Arts is a not-for-profit, 501c3, tax-deductible organization to serve young people and older adults. Right. We have classes on Wednesday for older adults. We call it recreational singing. And people sing for just the joy of singing, because music is medicine.
Yeah, I took that down, by the way. I'm taking notes. I took that one down. It's interesting because my wife has re-entered New York Theological Seminary and to finish her Master of Divinity, and I was asked to come and speak to her class. And one of the points I made is the point that you're making and you're testifying to, and your life is a testimony to. Because I'm, you know, concerned, we as black people showing what we want to be showing, what we're going to be showing, what we were. We've made progress. But I'm anxious about this question of history and identity and continuity of saying. And I talked about the fact, I was talking about gospel and the spirituals and how even in the church, you don't, they're not, some of them, sometimes you don't even hear, particularly the Negro spirituals. But the lessons that they mean in terms of our history, that somehow it's not sufficiently integrated and incorporated in our, even within some of our, even some of our more progressive churches even. So the question is, where do we learn in the black community? Certainly what you're doing for the schools are part of it, but I just wish we could embed this across the board in so many of our institutions, because it's life-saving. You know, it's like you said, the music is medicine. And I'm just... see here, almost tearing up here, and you talk about this because I passionately believe, as you believe, that we need this as we're going to heal our community, continue to build our community, because we are not there yet. I mean, we've got a way to go. And in fact, we're in such great crisis in so many of our communities, you can almost argue that it's needed more urgently than ever before.
I, you know, obviously I'm in total agreement. Somehow, especially in this climate we find ourselves in, it's easy to be separated from each other, and it focuses on our attention on our painful past. But you have to touch the pain.
That's right.
In order to move forward. You have to go back in order to move.
Right.
And that's how we have to realize the skills and the tools at hand and really appreciate how smart our ancestors really were and how we managed to work our way to be a little closer to some sense of freedom.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's a story we need to tell, and we're so happy that you are telling it, I got to tell you. I mean, and I'm just hopeful that, and I know what will happen is because the seeds that you're planting, with hundreds and hundreds of young people coming through, those seeds will be planted in the community, and, you know, they'll be pushing up through the weeds and all the other stuff to show some light and some hope and promise, and we urgently need that. I do want to have you share with the audience your contact information, how people can connect with the foundation, whether it's a website, phone number, or whatever, because we certainly
Absolutely.
Want people to be supportive.
I would love that. And, you know, the several programs that we offer are the Young People's Program. We recruit young people, and we have open admissions and registration all year. We used to do just a few days of auditions. We don't do that anymore because we want to make sure we don't miss anyone. And so our MAMA Foundation for the Arts .org, MAMA, M-A-M-A, Foundation.org, is our website. Recreational singing is called Wednesday Sings, for people who just the joy of singing. And you can reach that on our website as well. Then our theatrical productions are Alive 55 Plus and Kicking, and that's for our older adults. And we just concluded our season this past Saturday, but we plan to come back again in the spring. But what is most exciting for me now is the holiday concerts, good news concerts, we call them, and they happen on December 2nd and December 9th. This is something you want to do because we need music now more than ever. So so these two are up, and that, too, is on our website. And our telephone number is 212-280-1045.
Okay, I'm certainly going to put that out several times, and I'm going to put the good news concerts on my wife and I's agenda. And just as an aside, I know she's her church, Camarena Congregational Church, she was telling me the other day, she said, oh, yeah, I forget his name now, but he's one of the members of that congregation was a part of the Kickin' 55 cast.
And, right.
So she was sharing that with me, you know, and so forth.
But, you know, the best part about that, because, you know, part of the reason why the information spreads is because, you know, this is a great fundraiser for church groups, clubs, and organizations. You have a theater party, you come to see the show, and you raise money for your organization. We give you, the organization, a discount, and you charge the amount you like, and you make the difference between the two. So
right.
People come in groups of 30 and 40, you know, and enjoy the show, have a bite to eat at one of the participating restaurants, and everybody wins. So right. It's a great fundraiser, especially these two coming up.
Right. Well, we're with the Institute of the Blackwell 21st Century. We're stretched and thin and doing stuff all over the country and all over the world, but the fundraising component is something we would be interested in as well. So we're going to be finding ways to partner with you on that as well.
I like it. I like that a lot.
We could talk to you for the entire show. There's so many other questions I'd like to ask. Woody King is coming up next, however, so I got to get to him as well. But thank you so much for kicking off this tribute to Black theater, arts, and dramatic expressions. It was everything I wanted it to be and more. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
All right, Vi Higginson. What a tremendous start. We're going to take a break, and we come back. Another legend joins us. It's Woody King coming up next. We'll be right back.
Right, baby?
Right, Daddy. Girl, you were amazing, and you look absolutely sensational.
Dylan, he's a great producer. He makes hits.
We gotta change your name, Amara.
You sang like an angel.
And now I wonder what happened to that beautiful young lady.
My daughter is dressed like a prostitute gyrating on that stage.
We judge others, but we justify ourselves.
Half of what she preaches is aimed directly at me.
I need you to walk by.
I don't know Amara.
Because you don't want to know Amara.
I just came by to let you know that all things are possible.
I can talk to thousands of people, but I can't talk to my children.
It's not talking, not preaching.
Everything seems to be falling apart.
You need to slow down.
You're not my mother.
What the hell was that? Honey, you gotta regroup.
God's love will get through it.
Who do you trust?
You trust yourself.
Daddy told me to follow my dreams, and that's exactly what I'm doing.
Oh, well, what a phenomenal, I'm speechless, phenomenal opening with Vi Higginson coming in to talk about her work. And I really enjoy doing this because, you know, you see people and you on stage and on television. She's been on 60 Minutes, a whole number of other things. But it's this side, it's the personal side. It's digging into the roots that to me is always fascinating and revealing. And we certainly got a sense of her story. And that's what I like. I like the narrative. I like the story that people tell in terms of what inspired them and what made them do or encouraged them and inspired them to do what they do. And what incredible work. We have now joining us another person who has contributed so much for so many years. He's another legend in the world of black theater and black arts and culture and dramatic productions. Most recently saw him again at the 50th anniversary of Hakeem Adabudi's Third World Press and all of the institutions that he's put together. But it was also a celebration of the black arts and cultural movement. I can only go through for a quick minute as I was on this frenetic pace that I'm keeping. But it was so good to see him as well. And he's none other, and you know him well. If not, you will get to know him today. Woody King joins us now. Woody, thank you so much for joining us for this very special program.
Thank you, Dr. Daniels.
Yes, so again, it was so good to see you out in Chicago and that sort of family reunion of sorts that was going on, and you were right there in the middle of it, and you necessarily would be, given all the work that you've done. Just want to start with a little background information, because I always like to know about people, where they hail from and all that kind of stuff. So are you a native New Yorker?
No. I'm from Detroit. Uh-huh. I arrived in New York in 1964 during the midst of the Black Arts Movement. And I started a theater in Detroit called Concept East. And that theater, along with so many other theaters around America, proliferated at that time. And along with the Free Southern Theater, Inner City Culture Center in Los Angeles, Black Arts Repertory in New York. So we started in Detroit.
Right. Now, talk about your background, because we're gonna get to the theater and all that. But I want to know a little bit about who Woody King is. Came out of Detroit. Herb Boyd is Detroit to the bone, and he was there as well. So, what are the early influences? What is it that sort of drove you in this direction in terms of your early life experiences?
What drove me towards theater?
Yes.
I was an avid moviegoer, and early in my life, as a matter of fact, 2 or 3 weeks after high school, like most African Americans, I was searching for a direction. High school was the apex, and then you graduated, you're at the bottom again, so you search for a career other than college. And I was searching, and I saw Sidney Poitier in a movie with Tony Curtis called The Defiant One.
I remember that.
And I said, that's what I want to do. It was a black man, dark skin, very much like most African Americans who want this and don't see no images of themselves. And Sidney Poitier was it. So I started studying Sidney Poitier's life story. And at 16 or 17, he had left Nassau, Bahamas, and went to Miami, hitchhiked to Miami, however he got there, and ended up in New York looking for work. And he saw an ad that said, actors wanted. He thought it was a job. But he was living on rooftops in New York this summer, and he was used to that. And he saw actors wanted. It was the American Negro Theater. So one thing led to the other. Sidney Poitier's life at 16 or 17, could not read. And at 24, he was nominated for Academy Award for The Defiant Ones. So my life took that direction, you understand? My life wanted that. My God, a person trained himself to read, to speak fluently, and by listening to the radio and doing bit parts and very small parts in theater at the American Negro Theater. So Sidney Poitier's life led me to the American Negro Theater. And there I was in Detroit, graduated high school, getting ready to go to college, and I had no direction. And that gave me a direction.
Talk to me about your family. Were there inspirations, were there influences in your family that helped you to move in this direction and that gave you and maybe instilled some of this passion?
No. I was raised by a single mother who's a domestic, who really took good care of me, kept me out of gangs, etc. But no one in my family had ever participated in theater, not to my knowledge.
Right, right. So then you come to New York, and so what's the you already sort of suggesting what the inspiration may have been, but you put together this, I mean, it can only be considered historic and phenomenal institution. What was the inspiration about that, for that, and how did it all come together?
Well, when you say institution, I told you I had started a theater in Detroit.
Right.
You know, and so in coming to New York, I worked at in the poverty program, mobilization for youth, and you had to have a degree, and I had a degree, and I was young and energetic, and I got this great job with mobilization for youth, a poverty program, and taught young people dance, music, theater, filmmaking, and so it was like successful, very successful. It brought me a lot, brought a lot of attention to me. And but still, I was studying acting with the great Lloyd Richards, and directing with Wynn Hanman at the American Place Theater. So I was a 24/7 person in the arts.
And that led then to sort of continue to tell us about, because you began to put together programs, and you ultimately put together the New Federal Theater. Is it that stage? Does that come later? Just sort of fill in the blanks.
New Federal Theater came in 1970.
Right.
And it was after New Lafayette Theater, after Negro Ensemble Company, after National Black Theater. Along the same time, Studio Museum in Harlem. I mean, the Black Arts Movement was flourishing. I mean, we were everywhere. It was so many dance company, Black Dance Company, doing work, and theater was just another form of Black arts controlled by African Americans. And what made the us so important, I think, is we were African Americans. We were tired of looking for work and participating and trying to get visibility with white organizations. So we started doing our own. It happened out in Chicago with Haki Madhubuti. It happened with Obasi. It was happening all over the country. So the Black Arts Movement came almost simultaneously or immediately after the riots, Watts in 64, 65. You know, it was like everywhere.
Right.
Detroit, 67. Newark, 68. New York. You know, it was happening everywhere. And as a result of that, the Johnson administration sort of like put a lot of money into American inner cities And some of us took advantage of that. And in taking advantage of that, we started organizations, and these organizations proliferated.
Right. Now, yeah, and that's a, you know, one of the things I talk about to younger audiences today, because we have all kind of analysts on TV and so forth and so on, and they don't, you know, you talked about working in the poverty program and what that meant, and the Johnson administration, for whatever his frailties and difficulties may have been, did an urban policy that injected resources into the community that we were able to seize control of, and not control totally, but we could certainly take advantage of in the era of Black power and Black nationalism, and begin to do some things innovatively and creatively with, which does not exist now. It just does not, and it's not even, it's actually gone the other direction. But that's sort of one of the sort of an interesting thing that a lot of people don't remember much of. But you, in terms of your work, just influenced so many people, because you had programs where people could come and take classes and be mentored and taught and whatever. Talk to us about that experience and some of the people who've, I mean, just extraordinary people that you have mentored or who came through your program and have gone on to have incredible success.
Well, you know, if we start with mobilization for youth. I had some of the top artists in New York at that time come in, and I paid them to teach them. You know, Lonnie Elder, Cliff Frazier, musicians, Kenny Dorham. You know, it was like an unbelievable list of artists, musicians, who came down there on the Lower East Side, and those who wanted music, those who wanted dance went to Rod Rogers, those who wanted theater and the great experience of Irving Vincent and Ed Cambridge. And then when I went into mobilization for youth, when I went into founding the theater, I put on plays that related to Black Americans. I brought in artists that related to African Americans that people could relate to and saw, see images of themselves, because I came out of that kind of environment where we did not see images of themselves. So I was going to do what I could to correct that. And so playwrights like J.E. Franklin with Black Girl, Mickey Grant with and J.E. Franklin with Prodigal Sister, J.E. Franklin, Ed Bullins, Amiri Baraka, all the works of Ed Baraka, Slave Ship, and all of his works I was the producer of, and many of Ed Bullins' works, and Ron Milner, and artists who acted in those plays, the plays of Lawrence Holder, where you would see a Denzel Washington, the plays of Jack Gilbert, where you would see a Morgan Freeman, Samuel L. Jackson, where you would see the works of new writers like Sam Art Williams. So I was a place where these people could come and get work. And they went on into the industry and integrated into Hollywood and integrated into television. Denzel went from our theater to St. Elsewhere. Felicia Richard went from our theater to The Cosby Show. So it was a feeding for these new kinds of television. And then there was those who came back after those televisions series, like Esther Rolle. I mean, you understand, the 60s, I mean, the 70s was fertile.
Right.
It was like, it was a place where artists like these that I just mentioned could come and do plays, and between acting jobs in L.A. and other places. And we became popular. We became the place to be.
Right.
And it was a wonderful time, Ron. Art was everywhere.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right, right.
It was like, I mean, we lived, we breathed it, you know,
right.
From Barbara Antier's National Black Theater,
yes.
You know, to Robert Macbeth's New Lafayette to Douglas Turner Ward and Robert Hooks and Gerald Prawn's Negro Ensemble Company. It was a place where...
It was like a new renaissance.
It was a whole new renaissance, but we didn't know that. So we called it the Black Arts Movement.
Yeah, I got you. Let me ask you this, though, because I guess one of the things I struggle with and lament with, and we talked about this a little bit out in Chicago with Haki and others, is it seems that this is so important. This is so urgently needed, this foundation of Black arts and culture. It is liberating. Vi Higginson just mentioned, she said, music is medicine, and I firmly believe that. The question is, why should we still be struggling? When I say we, I'm uniting with you and whatever and so forth. So I wonder, I don't want to necessarily call names and all that, but it just seems that so many people have come through who now are millionaires, who are well-established. And one of the things we all sort of, our parents used to talk back at each one, reach one, pull one back and so forth and so on. What is the degree to which folks like this are actually contributing back, not just in terms of showing up, but in terms of tax write-offs that could help keep theaters alive? Because it seems like a lot of the theaters today are struggling to preserve the mission. And it would seem that if people sort of look back and actually contributed, it would be phenomenal in terms of keeping this foundation alive.
Well, yeah, you understand, you do understand, when federal, city, and state who give white institutions enormous funds, okay, and the Nixon administration, the Reagan administration iced that. They said no more. Okay? That was before these young African Americans proliferated in Hollywood and in television. And you know what happened with the black exploitation films. They weren't making any money. They was getting a lot of visibility. But now they're making a lot of money. These artists, millionaires, like you said, trillionaires. And you saw in Chicago, people like Danny Glover came out and supported Haki's 50th. Denzel Washington supports Woody King, supports the Negro Ensemble. But, you know, they can't support us like traditional non-white theaters are supported. So I would say if you look at the white institutions, theatrical institutions in New York, if you look at the Roundabout Theater, if you look at Manhattan Theater Company, Lincoln Center, Goodman Theater in Chicago, where Haki is, those institutions are $18 million institutions. Their chairman of the board are $250,000 a month and bonuses. That's what their chairman makes. Where they might be head of Sony, they might be head of, any Samsung, any of those institutions, because these are white millionaires who intend for European culture to proliferate, to exist, and they are not going to let them fall. And these institutions are not going to do any plays except those plays that focus on European culture. I'm not going to do any plays that focus on anything but African-American culture. And so, therefore, the money we get from federal, city, and state is minuscule. It's nothing. Okay, so if it wasn't for the Denzel Washingtons and the Sam and LaTanya Jacksons, I mean, we would be doing nothing in donations and contributions from African Americans. Yes, we are suffering. We are not. We can't pay our actors what Lincoln Center can pay an actor. So these people are basically supporting the theater by their work,
right,
and getting paid a lot less. So their rent is the same as the white actor who's working. They have to pay for getting to the subway the exact same amount that an African-American has to pay. So they have to get to work. So, yes, racism plays a major part. And everybody says, oh, man, Denzel's making all this money. Why don't he? Denzel is hit on by every nonprofit in America, plus the white ones, plus the Boys Club of America. You know, so I can't say he should support all these institutions. I don't know what his life is like on the other side, you know. No one knows what someone's life is like on the other side. All I know is, as the head of these institutions, and I love Hakeem Madhubuti for this, he keeps working.
Right.
No matter what, I keep working. I keep writing letters. I keep asking. I keep reaching out. So when someone says, Woody, tell us about your organization, I tell them that does not mean that if I run a show 5 weeks, the first 3 weeks, African-American people don't come and see it. I may be 50% full. In the last 2 weeks, you can't get a ticket, and they want me to keep it going. But that it doesn't work like that.
Right.
You gotta come in. You gotta come. If we open October 19th, we can't play to 20 people. And we've been promoting, calling people, sending out flyers, passing out flyers, but they'll come the last week because they got so many other things they gotta deal with.
Right.
So that's the predicament. So to talk about the people who came through, we could not play at all if they did not come through. You know?
Right, right.
So we are here struggling like everybody else, but as the head of the organization, I have to do twice as much. If the average person reaches out to 100 people for help, I got to reach out to 300 people for help.
Right, right. Well, Woody, as we conclude this part, we certainly want to share some information about you. You're certainly continue to do incredible work, and we wanted people to hear, and you've already said and talked about the value, and that's what we want our audience to understand, the value, because it's not only about the Denzels and whomever, and the Jacksons and so forth. It's about us, too. It's about our individual willingness to commit and come and attend, make contributions, and all of that to sustain that which has sustained us and is so urgently and vitally needed. So talk to us about some of the forthcoming productions that you may have in the K or that are coming up. And then finally, give us a way that people can contact you with the New Federal Theater.
Okay. I got to tell you, contributions from African-Americans of $25, $50, $75, they don't have to give $5,000, $10,000. So they got to know that any kind of contribution is welcome. Our address is 543 West 42nd Street, New York, New York, 10036. That's the New Federal Theater, 543 West 42nd Street, New York, New York, 10036. Our phone number is 212-353-1176. That's 212-353-1176. The upcoming productions are Harriet Tubman by Karen Jones Meadow. It will open February 8th. That's Harriet Tubman by Karen Jones Meadows. It will open February 8th and run to March 11th. So, and we did that because we have to program in advance. the word was she might be on the $20 bill, so I went looking for a play about Harriet Tubman so African Americans could know her contribution, her work, and see images of her as she moved about the stage dealing with issues.
Right.
Okay. Our final production that's May, June is a play by Richard Wesley called Autumn. A play called Autumn by Richard Wesley. And he is a prolific playwright, well known. He's been doing it for 25, 30 years. And that's about an African-American mayor of a predominantly African-American city. And he wants to rise and go to governor of that state, and how the white system blocks him in every way. Okay, so that's the political play.
Right.
And they can call us. You need my email is newfederal@aol.com.
Newfederal@aol.com. Okay.
Pardon?
I'm just repeating, newfederal@aol.com.
Yes. And our website is www.newfederaltheater.com.
And can people make contributions online?
Yes, they can make contributions online by going to www.newfederaltheater.com.
Okay, well, Whitty King, one of the reasons I wanted to do this entire show today about black theater, dramatic productions, and so forth was for this reason. Obviously, there are other megaphones and microphones out there, but this is my little small contribution to share with
big,
the audience.
It's a major contribution, Dr. Daniels.
Yeah, to get the word out to it. And we'll be looking at ways that the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, too, can be as supportive as we can, you know, moving forward. But I really wanted to get this story told, and it's so powerful, it's so important, because for me to be on the radio is, I'm a radio activist. I mean, I do lots of different things, but I do this because it's action oriented. I want our audience to be plugged in and to be able to support this basic infrastructure that has been so important to our survival, our maintenance, and to me in terms of moving into the future. And you have been a central part of that. And that's why I wanted you to be on today, and we really, really appreciate your historical contribution and the fact that you ain't no ways tired as you continue to keep pushing on. So thank you, Whitty King. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Daniels. Thank you.
All right. Okay. All right. We continue to move on. Take a break here. Come back. The poet laureate of East St. Louis, Illinois, that is, Eugene Redmond, will take us to the next step. We'll be right back after this break.
You want to fight? Oh, you want to fight, huh? Well, go ahead, pick liquor, huh, fellas? Let's get it on.
Yeah.
Come on, fellas. Man, you sure you want to get in this? You look kind of shaky to me.
Oh, man, you just be quiet. Watch, man. Fight me good. Fight.
Yeah, that's right. I want to fight you now. I want to kill you.
Well, God damn it, man. Fight, man. Come on, fellas.
God damn it, you bastard.
No, right. I want to fight you. I want to fight you.
Look, now, Carolus, you're just going to get your head blocked.
No. You have to fight me. It's saying that note, remember?
Oh.
The note saying I loved you. The note saying you're beautiful.
I left my home in Nashville. Look here what I got. 20 long years on a chain gang, sweating and busting rock. Judge, he come from Memphis, put me in the pen. If I ever do see his face once more, he never get home again. That judge be long gone to Kentucky. Long gone don't mean baby. Long gone, what I mean, a long gone judge on a bowling green. Bowling green, sewing machine. A little kitten sitting on a sewing machine. So in my sheath, so, so fast, so 11 stitches in a little cat's tail. Bowling Green.
Okay, we're back, and we just can't thank our chief announcer, Michael G. Haskins, enough, too, because he just works so beautifully with me on these programs, because I am so stretched out and stressed out doing so many things that you just be getting the raw interviews. But he always makes sure that he integrates and incorporates appropriate music, sound, audio, with whatever we're doing, and we really thank him so much for that, because I'm hanging on by a thread, as many of us are doing. But again, our show today is a tribute to black theaters and dramatic expressions, led off with Vi Higginson, and that was so powerful, and then Woody King, another powerful testimony to, and just listen to the work, the dedication, the vision, the courage, and the ongoing commitment. A luta continua, the struggle. I mean, and you know, and the question is, when will we not have to struggle so hard as black people to do these things? That's really one of the questions we have to raise. But joining us now is a dear friend, beloved. I had the honor of helping to contribute to the founding of the Institute for African American Education at Kent State University, that eventually evolved into the Department of Pan-African Studies way back in the day, about 1971 or so, somewhere in that range, maybe 1970 even. And Quincy Troop was a part of that, and Fela Shawande, Haleem Heldaab, who recently passed away, a huge story in the New York Times about him. And here's this young kid out of Youngstown, Ohio, by way of the Hill District of Pittsburgh, in the mix with these legends like Eugene Redmond. And so we welcome him now to this edition of Vantage Point. Gene Redmond, welcome to our show.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dr. Ron Daniels, the professor.
Yes, sir.
So good to be vibing with you this morning and the global audience. On this important subject of blackness generally and the black theater and the dramatic arts in particular, and the cultural underpinnings of all that.
Right, right. Well, we just had some of your co-partners on. We had Woody King just came on just before you.
I did. I got some of that.
Yeah.
Woody is one of my heroes.
Right, right.
And a great preserver. He's what Henry Dumas would call a cultural stabilizer.
A cultural stabilizer. I love
yeah,
that,
he
right.
He anchors.
That's right.
He's one of the greatest anchors of black culture in history.
Mm.
Mm. I mean, back to the ancients.
Right, I hear you. Mm.
I mean, what he has done with his productions, his work as an impresario, bringing on to the stage and to the national consciousness the works of people, you know, in their 20s. I'm talking, you know, Entezake, and I'm talking the playwrights out of Detroit, you know, and the playwrights from Chicago and New York and D.C. and important series that Woody King has done and is doing, where he put on special events to honor people in the dramatic arts and who do rituals and who do pageants. He originated a lot of it, and he continues to honor people who have done it, some of whom whom have gone on. And in fact, I just saw Woody 3 weeks ago. I was in New York. We were across the street from Marcus Garvey Park in Harlem at Mount Moriah's Park. Church. The Presbyterian Church. Well, we honored Larry Neal on the occasion of his, posthumously, of his 80th birthday.
Right.
And Woody was there, and David Henderson, whose book, The Mayor of Harlem, is a staple of black, neo-black literature. Felipe Luisiana.
Oh, yeah. He's associated we know with BAI. Oh, yes.
through, of course, the Last Poets. And we go on and on there. Evelyn Neal, Larry's widow, and his son, Avatar, Larry's son, Avatar, whom I knew when he was a babe in arms.
Right.
And so we were all gathered there to honor Larry Neal on what would have been his 80th birthday.
Right. Well, let's talk about let's talk about Eugene Redmond. You're the poet laureate of East St. Louis, Illinois, and all of that good stuff. But talk about your background. Were you born and bred in East St. Louis?
I was actually born in St. Louis at a hospital, Homer G. Phillips, where in those days most of the interns, black men and women on their way to being doctors trained, you know, because they couldn't go to other hospitals. So this was the black hospital in St. Louis, named after a lawyer and civil rights activist. Hmm. But then 6 months after I was born, my father moved the family to East St., across the river, to the very storied and incredibly germinating from a cultural standpoint, cultural vortex, if you will. You're talking Miles Davis. You're talking Leon Thomas. You're talking Barbara Ann Tier. You're talking Ambassador Donald McHenry. You're talking the Hudlin brothers, one of whom is a former student of mine. I come out of that. That's straight out of it. Will sometimes referred to as East Boogie, the east side of the Mississippi River. St. Louis is on the west side.
Right.
They often refer to us, two of us, as East St. Love and North St. Luck, because North St. Louis is where most of the black people live.
Right. I didn't know Barbara Ann Tier came out of there.
Of course. We all went to the same high school.
Oh, my goodness.
Barbara and I were classmates. She graduated ahead of me. And you know who else? Miles went to the school, of course, half generation before we did. And we're just restoring Miles' house, by the way. There's an elementary school here, the Miles Davis Elementary School. There's a Catherine Dunham Theater. There's a Catherine Dunham Performing Arts Center, inside of which is the Miles Davis Theater. I'll be actually reading some poetry there tomorrow night. And that's in the high school.
Okay.
Whole section of the high school. Captain Dunham Performing Arts Center, Miles Davis Theater inside.
Right.
So, Barbara Ann Tier, Jackie Joyner Kersee, the female athlete of the 20th century.
Oh, yes.
And all of this is, you know, keyed into the arts, because there's so much art coming out from across the globe, and specifically out of East St. Louis, dealing with Miles and Jackie and Dunham and Barbara Ann,
right.
who, as you know, of course, built that $10 million National Black Theater and Communications Arts Center.
That's right.
Right there in Harlem.
That's right, absolutely, right.
Oh, so, yeah, that's how I got started.
Right.
Now, you know, it's interesting how Dunham came here in 1967, Catherine Dunham.
Right. I was
gonna and first thing she said to me, Eugene, we have to develop a theater-going audience. Now, interestingly enough, most of the people around me with the exception of a handful of people who had traveled, who lived in New York, or had gone to other cities to see plays, had only seen little pageants in church or at school, and all of that culminated in the high school class play, which was almost never black-based. Like my class, for example, in 57, high school class, they dialed M for murder, right?
Oh, my goodness.
So what we did, with the help of Woody and Barbara and the, you know, just you can go in any direction that you want to with these great playwrights, whether it's Baraka or whether it's Ron Milner or whether it was Harrison, Carter, Paul Carter Harrison.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. With whom I worked for a couple of years at California State University in Sacramento, where he first staged Ain't Supposed to Die a Natural Death, which was, of course, the playwright, the playwright and director who wrote it. And his own, I'll be 80 in a few days, so give me a little time.
All right, well, I got you. And happy birthday to you right here
thank you.
On WBAI.
That's what we're doing. But we picked up on Dunham. We said, bet, we got to do this. And now, in every black community of size, there's some theater.
Right.
Now, it wasn't black theater. The early civil rights stuff, Blues for Mr. Charlie, Lorraine Hansberry, Langston Hughes, which was a staple of community theater, ahead of and during the Black Lives Movement, the important work of Owen Dotson at Howard, all these important forerunners. But basically, as I said, when you said a play, people stopped at their high school graduating classes, class play.
right.
And we turned it around.
Right.
Now there's a black rep or a variant thereof in every black community.
Right.
And you can see a black play in the area I live in at least once a month.
Right, right.
Two or three times a month.
It's going good. But
And that that reverbs around the country and the world.
Right.
So,
Gene,
it's great. When Ms. Dunham said we've got to develop a theater-going audience, she was actually talking about a theater in the most expanded
way
sense
right.
of the word.
I got you.
And of the idea, she meant something artful, something cultural, something that is a vehicle for our liberation and entertaining simultaneously on stage.
Right.
So whether it's spoken word, whether it's dance almost exclusively, or most of what we did in dance, it was dance theater, Dunham. So she meant, okay, read some books, stage some books, act some books, do a play, do Reader's Theater on your way to developing an acting troupe.
Right.
So, those are some of the things we did. Those are some of the things that I'm extremely proud of and happy about,
right.
that I can take you to a place in East St. Louis or St. Louis or almost any town around here and assemble 50 people who call themselves actors and actresses.
Right. Yeah.
Doing important work not just on stage, because it takes time, you know, to incubate a play. I mean, you got to practice, it's got to be written, and you got to read it, you got to, you know, do all the stuff that goes along with it. But you're talking about hitting those schools, hitting those churches, hitting those bars. I remember saying spell number seven, Shange's spell number seven in a bar in New York. And it's just, it's common.
Right.
So, you know, it helped carry SNCC, the NAACP. The NAACP has an Olympics that's called AXO.
That's right.
And it is art, cultural, and technology. Technology and science, AXO.
Right.
And it's a big thing. I mean, I've been a judge for some of the art events that is given. But, I mean, you know, all of that, everything I'm saying grew out of activism.
Right.
Grew out of the black liberation movement, regardless of where and what they were.
Right.
How they were conceived and what vehicle carried them.
Right.
So you had I remember going on stage and reading.
I'm trying to also ask the question. You're on a roll, brother. I'm trying to get a question. Can I get a question in?
Yeah, I appreciate all that. But I also want to talk about you a bit. We only got a few minutes left. So you've talked about the great influences, but you in your own right are a great poet. You know, you've written extensively, and you keep churning out poems all the time. So, and you're in East St. Louis. We get your grounding there. But I want to talk about what influenced you, what in your education, your family, what propelled you to become the poet that you are today and the contributions that you've made.
Well, you know, I was a little bit older, like Baraka, like Ray Patterson, and some of the others. We're older than people like, say, David Henderson and Hakimoto Obuta, who was Donnell Lee. Larry Neal was in the group I was in. So we were already adults when the movement struck. But so the movement helped me. In other words, I was going through a program, you know, one of those elite literary programs at an elite school, Washington University in St. Louis, a graduate school. And it's called one of the Harvards of the Midwest. And there were 9 black students there. But between near completion of a master's degree and consideration of a PhD, the movement, the streets blew up in my face.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, street heat. And so I told my one of my professors, I said, you know, I'm tired of reading dead white poets. And I have a little poem. It goes like this. In the 60s, we stopped reading dead white poets and started reading dead black ones. The only difference was the dead black poets were still alive because of their messages.
Right.
Like I say to my, they say, tell me the difference between black poetry and other poetry. I say, well, every black poet has written a poem about lynching. Mm. You can't say that about anybody in another race. Or you can't say that about white poets. There's no black poet who's ever lived who hasn't written a poem about lynching. So that's what got me in. Of course, I had that background. I had that literary background. And when I did Drum Voices, the critical history of black poetry, Doubleday, 1976, I would not have called a book of black literary history Drum Voices had it not been for the movement. You get it?
Right.
It would have been something like the Sacred Urn or something. You know, something that was more illusory and more referencing of Greco-Roman Hebraic Christian continuum. instead of what I teach and call the Afro-Asian, Hindu, Islamic, Hispanic, island continuum.
Right.
So yeah. I had then been really drilled in that Greco-Roman Hebrew Christian continuum. And then we, of course, started other writing. And that's how I got into, you know, writing the poetry and blackening the poetry. And it went along with my activism. And then, you know, running into Catherine Dunham and who came to East St. Louis in 1967 and said, we have to develop a theater-going audience. So I recognize that, as Larry Neal said, a poem is a script. You know, it doesn't have the umph until you actually activate it. And so that's how my work started to, with Dunham, was where I started to have my work staged. And I remember that we went on an East Coast tour, including 16 high schools in Connecticut. And of course, you know, you teach, and awards come, and, you know, to honor your literary merits and your literary art. And, that's how I got to where I am today, you know, retired. And my proudest achievement, outside of being named Poet Laureate of East St. Louis, a black city which had so many burdens, still it decided to name a Poet Laureate.
Mm,
I mean, there was so much going on in the city and so much turbulence economically and politically, and in the contact with the criminal justice system, there's so much that the city could have been, so many directions the city could have been looking at, as opposed to naming me Poet Laureate and having thousands of people come out to a park. My friend Quincy Troop came all the way here for it I was named.
Yes.
So I'm very proud of. But the next thing, and maybe co-ranked with number one, is that for 40-plus years, I made my living by writing about, thinking about, researching into, loving, lecturing, teaching black people.
Mm. Wow.
That's
a legacy, brother.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I made my living. And so every day I get up and I read a piece of black literature. Mm. And I read something out of Africa. And that's what I've done. I mean, I used to get up and translate a German poem every morning before I went to sleep at night. I would read a poem in German, translate it into English. I mean, I was a good student of the the Greco-Roman Hebraic. You get my point.
I got you, brother.
That's where I was.
Right.
And so, you know, I could wake up in the middle of the night and recite T.S. Eliot for as long as you would listen. And I wanted to get there with black poetry, with black literature, with black drama, with black musicians, and say to students, in 1926, Duke Ellington wrote and recorded East St. Louis Toodle Oo.
Mm.
In honor, 9 years later, of all of our people who were slaughtered in the 1917 East St. Louis race riot or pogrom. And so that's what I train young people to do. You know, don't start stuttering. You know, have that, live that on stage.
I hear you.
You walk on stage and you can give a 2 hour, you can do a one woman or one man 2 hour show without looking at a piece of paper on the depth and pith of blackness.
Right. All right.
So that's what we were given, and that's what we give.
Right. Well, Eugene Redmond, you certainly have done a great deal and bring that passion to our audience today, and to talk about that work, the Poet Laureate, but also that testimony of 40 years making your life, really dealing with, loving, and I mean, that was so poetic in and of itself, and really epitomizes who you are. Tell people how they can be in touch with you if they want to.
Sure.
Website or whatever that people can be in touch with. Sure. Eugene Redmond.
You can reach me at P.O. Box 6165, East St. Louis, Illinois, 62201. That's writing. Email E. Redmond. And I normally have a D on the end, but for purposes of the email, drop the final D. So it's E. Redmond. E-R-E-D-M-O-N, at S-Sam, I-India, U, Umbrella, E-Egypt, dot E-D-U. And if you just Google me, you know, you'll have a man and woman share of stuff to look at.
I got you, yeah.
Yeah.
As they say,
Google me, Google Dunham,
right.
The House of Miles is one of the websites we have. We're restoring Miles Davis's childhood home, and there's some wonderful people in charge of that that I work with. So you can Google East St. Louis. You can Google the Eugene B. Redmond Writers Club. That's another area.
So the problem, the point is, we can find you. No problem.
Yes, you can find me.
Right.
And you'll find out there's a Eugene B. Redmond Learning Collection and Learning Center at Southern Illinois University. Grand opening was in 2015. And I've accumulated more than 500,000 items, including a couple of 100,000 photographs of mostly black writers, black actors, black activists, black cultural figures, black teachers, black businesses, you know, you name it. You see me. You don't see me without a camera.
That's absolutely true. Look,
yeah.
We got to move on. Eugene Redmond, thank you so much for anchoring this very, very powerful program on a tribute to black theaters and dramatic expressions. You are the right person to close us out, and we're going to go to our listening audience.
Thanks, Professor.
All right.
And love you, man. Best to you and your family, immediate and extended.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. All right. Boy, I'm excited. We're going to go to our listening audience now. After we take this break, you can line up to talk about really what you've heard, but how do we, well, first of all, you can talk about what black arts and theater has meant to you. That's what we want to focus on. We want to keep our focus on that. And what we can do to get beyond the struggle. You heard Witty King talk about the struggle. National Black Theater is struggling. I mean, you know, Vi Higginson is, you know, trying to keep the programs free so she doesn't have to charge the young people. What can we do in order to strengthen these celebrated institutions? So it's not just, you know, kind of like being a testimonial or kind of as if it's in the past. We need this now. How do we perpetuate it? How do we continue it? Along with your reflections, you may talk about, you know, an experience that you had at the National Black Theater or with Vi Higginson, or you may actually know Eugene Redmond. Call us and talk about that at 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818. We're going to take a break and come right back to you and our listening audience here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Right back after this break.
People keep telling me to put my feet on the ground. I get mad and I scream. There is no ground. There's only from dogs, horses, and what? Men? Who don't live anywhere? They tell me to think straight and make myself something. I shout and I sigh. I am a poet. I write poems. I make words, cartwheel, and somersault down pages. Out of my mouth come visions distilled like bootleg whiskey. I'm like a radio. But I am a channel of my own because I keep saying I write poems and people, they keep asking me, what do you do? What in the hell is going on? People keep telling me these are hard times. What are you going to be doing 10 years from now? What the hell do you think? I'm going to be writing poems. I will have poems itching up the walls of the Lincoln Tunnel. I will feed my children poems of rye bread with horseradish. I'll send my doctor off with a poem for his wagon. My lover, a poem for their heart. I am a poet. I'm not a part-time poet. I'm not an amateur poet. I don't even know who that person's CDB. Whoever that is, authorizing poetry as an avocation? Is a fraud. So put your own feet on the ground.
Okay, we're back, and I want to reiterate what I said earlier. I really, really profound appreciation to our chief announcer here at WBAI, Michael G. Haskins, who, with such tender care and love for the entirety of the menu here at WBAI, you know, finds ways to enhance and complement what we do in a way that really, really embellishes it. Because, you know, we've had, I think, some powerful, powerful stuff today. And so the music you hear, the excerpt you hear, he put those in. I didn't have time to, couldn't find time to, but he cared enough and cares enough to insert those for us, and I really, really profoundly appreciate it. Just also, as we get ready to go to our phones, I just want to also say that this is our, you know, we have the holiday season coming up, and I call it Black Thanks, or the family holiday, and I say that because I want us always to remember Native Americans or indigenous people in this season. It is so important that we not have amnesia about that, you know, because there's a way in which this society just steamrolls and just bulldozes its way over the legacy and life of people. This is native land. We are all the inheritors, the beneficiaries of the dispossession of this land from native people. And so, you know, pause during the course of your celebration of family, if you will. And I can't tell you how what to do. I'm just, what we do, we family, and remember Native people and their trials and struggles and tribulations, but ultimately the triumph and that which yet must be done to make them whole in these United States of America. So I just wanted to put that out there as well. So we want to go to our listening audience. Again, the number to call is 347-335-0818, and our discussion is about the program itself, what you've heard, reflections. You may have gone to some of the plays, you may know some of these folks, or in a broader sense, what can we do? Vi Higginson talked about having, you know, fundraising events where you can partner with the Mama Foundation. Similarly, you know, Woody King talked about what he's doing and how he's struggling to keep this message forward, and how, which is combating white supremacy and the fact that these institutions are well endowed, ours are not. How do we make sure that they're endowed, at least from a people-based perspective? And of course, Gene Redmond, you know, just talking about the history of it and giving this powerful tribute to Woody King. He really talked about him as really a cultural stabilizer, one of the greatest, he said, in our history. I mean, what powerful testimonies we've heard today. 347-335-0818. Let's go to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning. Is that me?
Yes, that's you. Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Brother Jackson, and I want to really thank you for the programs that you've been producing for the last, since you've been on the air, and it's very, very vital to the economical growth of black people or African people, wherever we might find ourselves in the world. And I just want to give you a solution, but I don't want to put it on the air. Is there any mailing address I can send it to, or anywhere I can drop it off where you will receive it?
Yeah, you can connect by way of WBAI, WBAI.org. They will convey the messages on to me that we receive, and we frequently get messages, so you can do that.
Okay, very good.
WBAI.org.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Appreciate so much your comments as well. Others can call at 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. And don't forget, we really want to keep on point and on subject in terms of just, you know, by Higginson, you may have gone to one of her plays or have something to say about her, or Woody King or Gene Redman, or ways in which we can be supportive. Those are the kind of things we want to talk about. I just found it so moving. I was almost brought to tears, like, listening to the passion and the dedication and how urgently this is needed. And I guess my tears are tears of pain, because I see a gap between that which we need and the resources that's required to do it. And, of course, you know, I know that, again, Denzel and Jackson and all can't do everything, but I just see, you know, athletes and artists signing multi-million dollar contracts, and we have people blowing up to be billionaires, which, you know, in the broader scheme of capitalism, doesn't make them magnets. But within the context of what we're trying to do to preserve institutions, you know, an endowment here, an endowment there, a significant check here or there would just save many of these institutions and save the need to just struggle so hard. But the other way to offset that is through numbers, massive numbers of people who support. And Woody King talked about that in the same way that we talk about here at WBAI in terms of pushing people to become WBAI buddies, that large numbers of people contributing a little bit becomes a mountain that can sustain us. And so that's, again, what has me so emotional and moved this morning, because I'm concerned about where we are in terms of our infrastructure of institutions. Let's go back to our listening audience. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello? Oh, I guess we don't have a caller. 347-335-0.
Yes. Good morning, Professor Rondanilis. How are you today?
I'm doing good, but we need you to come on now. We got to get a lot of callers in. So you like Gene Redman.
Yes,
said, you can't hesitate.
I appreciate
come right
your
on with
program
it.
Very much, and the topic this morning is very entertaining. And I think we can support our blackness a lot more, just like we support our black churches. And I think this message should go forth to every black church in this country to support the art.
Right.
It is not separate. It is inclusive.
Right.
And we think that it is separate. It is not. When we support the art, we are supporting our heritage, where we're from, and where we are going. And I endeavor to do so, to spread this message of support in every way. And I appreciate your endeavor to push forward, because the mountain is very steep, and we got to have energy to climb this mountain of racism.
Yes.
But we'll get there. And thank you, Professor.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your call. Yes, we can do it. We can overcome. And it doesn't have to be someday. It can be today, if in fact we apply it. I guess it would be good in some instances to pull together, you know, some of the folk who are doing this work and have maybe a conversation with faith leaders. I'm sure that there are many churches who do have usher boards and different ministries and so forth that do connect with these theaters, because that's a good way to have a fundraiser. And as Bob Higginson talked about it, it's mutually beneficial. You can raise money for your church program or your organizational program while simultaneously sustaining the work that they do. We have just got to be so much more intentional about that, you know. And I'm guilty too. I mean, I don't do as much as I could do, though I am stretched so thin trying to do as much as I can do. But one of the reasons I do a show like this and a program like this is that it's action oriented. It can perhaps lead to some solutions. It can perhaps jog your memory. Oh wow, yes, New Federal Theater, Woody King is still doing this, and there's a play coming up in February on Harriet Tubman, and another one coming up, you know, later in the year, and maybe I can plug in. You see, maybe this program helps to jog people in that way, and if it does, at least I've made a modest contribution towards the sustenance that we need. Let's go back to our listening audience. Again, you can call 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling to find out from you, doctor, if it is possible that you might get together with maybe another colleague of your own, sit down, do up a blueprint, tell some of these people that you are thinking of that the theater needs help, because they may not live in this area. They might live in another state. So, you know, like people say, they need or they have, a lot of people give money, but we just don't know about it. I don't think that they should be, you know, electrical piggy banks because of the fact that we need it. I did not hear the first interview, but I will say this, that we buy a lot of what we want. We buy anything that we want. So I understand her not wanting to charge young people, but, you know, you get people into the habit of buying tickets to go to the theater, because they buy anything they want for other things. So I think that we should get into the habit of getting them to spend their money, save their money, and put their money where their mouth is. I'm talking about the young people,
right,
and the older people can get together.
Right.
I mean, you're brilliant, and I know you can drum up a blueprint and let them know that, you know, we're in need.
Right. Well, we appreciate that suggestion, and I agree, too. Sometimes we have to sort of think about this because, you know, at some point, even young people have to make choices about what their priorities are. And maybe there's a way in which we help to incentivize that with scholarships and so forth the first round or so. But at the end of the day, freedom is not free, and this life is not free. And, you know, we find, again, young people who, if it's sneakers or this or that, the other, they will find ways to raise those dollars to get where they want. And so I agree with you. We have to have that socialization process that's teaching them of what it means to struggle and to have reward at the end of the struggle as we build these institutions is incredibly important. So we appreciate your suggestions, and keep listening to Vantage Point. We really appreciate it. Others can call at 347-335-0818, 347-335-0818. Let's go to our next caller. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Yes, good morning. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Very moved by the show.
The show has been beautiful, brother. Eugene Redmond, I got the P.O. box, but I didn't get the rest of that information. I was wondering, do you still have it?
Yeah, I actually, he went so fast till I actually didn't get it all. But if you Google Eugene Redmond, it the contact information will pop up. I'm trying to see whether I wrote down. Again, they were going so quickly. I don't know that I got a phone.
But if you didn't, I'll get it.
You'll be able to get it. Yeah.
And you had a fantastic show from the start and until you're talking now. Dwight Higginson, I sort of know indirectly, and I knew about Mama I Wanna Sing, so that was beautiful. And Woody King, you know, was fantastic. And then Eugene Redmond, he was the icing on the cake, you know. So you had a beautiful show. And, you know, I just hope people feel the way I feel and, you know, would tap into all that information that, you know, you gave us this morning. So I just wanted to share that and say that.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. We appreciate your remarks and your encouragement because that all helps. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Okay, we got a call. Got time for a couple of more calls. 347-335-0818. I enjoy this part of the program as much as anything because I like interacting with the audience, and I like to hear what you have to say in relationship to what we're doing and how we might move forward. And my brain is churning as if I don't have enough on my plate. My wife is sitting back in the background saying, "There he goes again. He's thinking of other things to do." Yeah, well, I'm doing that too, but. It's because, you know, we have to keep moving. We have to keep working. We have to keep finding solutions to the predicament we find in ourselves in. And it's not that we haven't made progress. We certainly have. But when I hear you go back and listen to the where the origins and what people have done and what they've sacrificed and committed to bring us to this point, then I have to say I ain't no ways tired. And we have to keep pushing. 347-335-0818. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning. My name is Veronica, and I just want to say that at age 8, my mother took me to see a play entitled How Deep Are Your Roots? And this play was given at a high school across the street from where we lived on Herkimer Street in Brooklyn. And I thought it was so fascinating that the play, one of the actors in the play was going up the stairs on the stage, and I was just so fascinated by the props and the staging. But ever since then, I've been a very avid theater goer, so much so that people think that I'm an actor, which I'm not. But another idea I had, too, in reference to raising money for the theater is to perhaps start a National Black Theater Fund wherein if I purchase a ticket for an off-Broadway play, which I think are the best plays because sometimes we have the best plays that will never get to Broadway, and we have to keep in mind that a lot of our plays, black theater, is off or off-Broadway, but to develop a national theater fund. So if a ticket is $15, I can be asked to donate $20, and that $5 additional dollars can start to build a national treasury so that plays can perhaps be given free at some schools or be given free at different venues, but then the actors will still get compensated, the playwright will be compensated, the venue will be paid for. So that's just my contribution in terms of how to keep black theater alive. Thank you. Excellent idea.
I've taken note of that. I mean, that is an excellent idea, and we appreciate you so much. And keep going to the theater. All right, let's take one more call if we can at 347-335-0818. 347-335-0818. You see, inside of Black America, even though we are still relatively poor vis-a-vis capitalism per se, as Reverend Dennis Dillon reminds us, though, if we had the aggregate consumer power, were a nation, we would be the, I think, something like the 11th nation, most powerful, most wealthy nation in the world. So we have resources. The question is how to organize them effectively. And this idea of having strategic funds like a black theater fund, actually, we need, and that's been worked on, you know, how do we get the National Black United Fund funded sufficiently? And by the way, that's why we're all still fighting for reparations, which is the project I'm working on now as we move towards New Orleans. Let's take this last call quickly. Good morning. You're on Vantage Point.
Good morning, Dr. Daniels. This is Lorraine Stone. What a wonderful program. I catch you as often as I can.
Thank you.
But being a performance artist, actress, storyteller, this was absolutely marvelous. I feel like I've been to school this morning with the greats from the performance and theater world. And I really like the suggestions from callers about how we can be more consistent, how we can raise funds. One big challenge we have here, I live in Monmouth County. Dunbar Repertory Company is the group that I work with.
Yes.
People wait to buy the tickets. And sometimes when we're performing in a big house, white folks get nervous. If they don't see the ticket sales, they're like, well, this isn't going to work.
Right.
No, we can't do this. So we need to understand that when the play is there, get your tickets, go on out and see it. And I would love for every theater goer to be able to think around tax time, I can give $10. To my local theater. It would be a wonderful thing.
Right.
Thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
Okay, and thank you so much. Another great suggestion. That ties in with what Woody King talked about in terms of we and it's like now. I mean, we're doing something in New Orleans, and I'm sitting here in pins and needles. All the black people going to show up. And sometimes we wait, and we were doing State of the Black World Conference, and we were waiting for the early registration. We tried to incentivize it, but the people waited to the last minute. You know, we have ulcers. You know, it's all right. We're gonna get over that. But connecting early would be helpful. Anyway, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening in and the positive feedback. Again, another just shout out to Michael G. Haskins, our chief announcer, for his aid and assistance. And we're going to keep on pushing these kinds of programs here on WBAI. That's why I'm glad to be on the air, and also encourage you to keep us on the air by being a WBAI buddy. Go to give2wbai.org, and for as little as $10, sign up, $120 a year or more to become a WBAI buddy to sustain us and keep us moving. This is the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. We'll see you again next week here on Vantage Point.
It's a pleasure to present to you Cab Calloway.
Droning a drowsy syncopated tune. Rocking back and forth to a mellow croon. I heard a Negro play. Down on Lenox Avenue the other night, by the pale, dull pallor of an old gaslight, he did a lazy sway. He did a lazy sway to the tune of those weary blues. With his ebony hands on each ivory key, he made that poor piano moan with melody. Oh, blues. Swaying to and fro on his rickety stool, he played that sad, raggy tune like a musical fool. Sweet blues coming from a black man's soul. Oh, blues. In a deep song voice with the melancholy tone, I heard that Negro sing that old piano moan. Ain't got nobody in all this world. Ain't got nobody but myself. I's gwine to quit my frownin' and put my troubles on the shelf. Thump, thump, thump went his foot on the floor. He played a few chords, then he sang some more. I got the weary blues, and I can't be satisfied. Got the weary blues, and can't be satisfied. I ain't happy no more, and I wish that I had died. And far into the night, he crooned that tune. The stars went out, and so did the moon. The singer stopped playing and went to bed, while the weary blues echoed through his head. He slept like a rock. That's dead.
Langston Hughes, The Weary Blues. on WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. As Professor Daniel said, please consider becoming a sustaining member to WBAI. Visit us online at WBAI.org. This is our radio station.